Welcome to Watching Silent Films. This is Yifeng, and with me are my co-host Lily, and I guess Adam, you can be our co-host.
Hello there.
Hello.
How are you?
Greetings. Today we're going to, what we do on this podcast, we watch a film or a series of shorts on silent in the silent era. We talk about it. That's pretty much all we do. And today we're going to talk about The Wind, that Victor Seastrom, or Stroheim, however you pronounce his last name. In 1928. Before we get on there, have you guys watched anything in the classic realm? You don't have to. Just throwing it out there.
Excuse me.
If you guys had a chance.
Well, not in the classic realm, but I did watch a short film that was featured on YouTube for some reason, probably because it was by a Coppola in there. But it was called Daddy. It features Dylan Sprouse and Ron Rifkin. It was about 18 minutes, but it was very interesting. Dylan Sprouse is an escort, essentially, and basically Ron Rifkin's character is an elderly man who lost his wife. So he's kind of just trying to live it up at the very end, but it's very poignant. They say on the internet with all the comments that it's the idea that Dylan's character is death, and he's giving Ron Rifkin's character the last hurrah. So it was very interesting. Good cinematography. Dylan Sprouse is gorgeous, so throwing that out there. But yeah, I liked it for a short.
Sounds interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if he's related to any of the other Coppolas. Oh, that's right. So he is a distant relative of Francisco. I was like, there's got to be, it can't be a coincidence to have that last name and not be related to Francis Ford, but he is a distant relative.
Yeah, he's younger than I am. And I was just like, oh my God.
Yeah, he's a distant relative of Francis Coppola.
Well, it would make sense. Most people in the entertainment business, they keep it within.
Yeah, then nepotism, right?
Yeah. It's been going on forever.
Of course.
Look at the Barrymores.
That's right.
Was that it for you? Or, Lily?
Yeah, that was the only film that I've recently watched. Unfortunately, not in the classics, but it was a film. It's very hard for me to watch films, as we've quite frequently discussed, unless it's for the podcast, but I was happy to actually watch this one because I do a lot of film work, so I always enjoy seeing the release and then imagining what they were exactly doing behind the scenes, since I usually work that area.
Yeah, you didn't work on this one, right?
No, that would have been cool though.
Yeah.
But just like shot choices and understanding why the director of photography is doing certain lighting the way it is, like the costume designer, what that really means, even like who they choose for their characters, even if it's a short role, obviously their presence means something in the audition room. So that part is like what intrigues me the most, because I know Cole and Dylan Sprouse growing up from like The Suite Life of Zack and Cody, that stupid show on Disney Channel. But now that they're older, they're finally kind of branching out to different roles. Like, his brother does that Riverdale show, which is based on the Archie Bunker comics, where Dylan's kind of more, this is the only film I know that he's done, but they're kind of just doing different things from cutesy, fun Disney stuff. They seem to be into darker, edgier roles, and I can dig that.
So what'd you say the title was?
Just Daddy.
Daddy.
You can probably Google that with Coppola, and you'll probably hit it. Hit something. Mm-hmm. It's probably only one short movie with those combinations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I'll check it out.
Yeah.
Well, I was looking for something. Well, I saw a couple. The first one was Theater of Blood, 1973. That was with Vincent Price and Dinah Rigg, Ian Hendry. Dinah Rigg and Vincent Price said that was their favorite film that they did. Dinah Rigg was known for The Avengers, which is not the comic, but the show in England. It was kind of a spoof on James Bond. Ian Hendry actually started it off, so it was fun to see both of them in the same film since they were both in the Avengers. Basically, it's a Shakespearean actor that takes poetic revenge on the critics who denied him recognition. So he thought he, everyone thought that he had killed himself by leaping off of out of a window in a building. But there was a shelter where addicts and homeless people in general took him in and nursed him to health. And basically, between him and his daughter, they just started killing people one by one, done the same way that certain Shakespeare plays would be done. The Avengers has always been one of my favorite shows growing up. And it's basically, people are getting killed, but you never take it seriously because it's not done seriously. And they always had creative camera angles, or sometimes they used a fisheye lens for, a seemingly boring scene, where someone's just walking from A to B, but they still make it look interesting. There was one murder where a critic was forced to eat his two beloved dogs because it was baked in a pie and he didn't realize it was his prize dogs inside. So that was his comeuppance. And then somehow they killed him that way. I forgot. I don't remember how they actually got. They must have. Oh, I know what they did. They put a funnel on his mouth and just kept feeding him the food until he basically died. There was another one where he posed as a hairdresser, and the woman critic was coming in to have her hair done, but she got electrocuted by the hair rollers. There was a lot of blood in this, but it was so bright red that it was obviously paint.
Well, I'm sure it's also not as gory as modern horror. It's
Oh
probably.
no, it was like Monty Python gore, it just
But it's not
you could.
like, like the torture porn that modern
No,
Saw
nothing
franchises
like
and
that.
yeah, that's what I mean.
Although they would cut off someone's head and place it next to the woman, so when she woke up, her husband's head was would roll off the body. That's what it was. The other one I watched was a Japanese film, Yusajiro Ozu, in 1959. He was like the master of the mundane. He just all of his films are really, really slow. And you're basically watching it because each scene is set up like a photograph or a painting, and it's always the relationship between older and younger, just different groups of people and how they treat each other, and it kind of it's just like watching a painting turn into a movie where you're just watching the movie for that reason, and that's it.
So which Ozu did you watch again?
It's called The Floating Weeds. It's in color.
Yes.
I think
So
it's like the third color.
we recommended one a few months ago, I can't remember.
Tokyo
Called
Story?
that or Late Spring. It's probably Late Spring,
Oh, yeah.
1949.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, it's I mean he's an amazing director. So he's
Yeah.
most people I think can name probably potentially if they're a film nerd Akira Kurosawa I would say
Oh, yeah.
but when you get into Ozu that's kind of deeper cuts a little bit of Japanese
They're
cinema
polar opposites, him and Kurosawa.
yeah but then
Kurosawa is all about action. Uzo isn't.
right exactly but I think both are very much about character which is
Yeah. Oh,
why
yeah.
they've had great success over the years.
Well, this one is about a head of a Japanese theater troupe that returns to a small coastal town where he left. He went to visit his old girlfriend who had a son by him, but he just tells the son that he's the uncle. Meanwhile, his mistress grows jealous, and they go from there.
Right, I mean that's the whole thing that he does. It's very much about like family relationships and conflicts.
Right.
I'd say majority of his filmography is like
Yep.
that. He has done a series of silent films. I'm not sure what
Yep.
kind
In the
of
30s.
availabilities exist.
They're all on Criterion. There's quite a few. And some of them are comedic. Their silent films lasted through the 30s.
50s.
Oh,
50s.
up that high?
Yeah,
I know
because
Italy did, but I didn't think,
well, many of
this.
the countries outside US had silent films through the 30s and 40s. It depends on which country.
Oh, no, no, no. Italy used silent equipment and then dubbed afterwards. That's what their thing was.
Right. But Japanese...
That's why the voices never went.
Would have gone longer because they used to have... Oh, man, I'm going to forget the term now. But there's this person who would describe using a microphone while the film is playing, describe what's on screen and culturally translate what's going on screen. And I'm going to figure out this term. Japanese silent narrator?
Yeah,
Benshi.
I don't know.
That's what it's called. Benshi. So Benshi is the term that is provided for a type of role. It's a job. At some point, there was like hundreds, if not thousands, of these people during the height of these silent film era. And they used to basically narrate when the films would be imported into Japan. They would not just do a direct translation of the dialogue, the Western films, but they actually explain to the culture why Americans were doing things that are totally opposite of their own culture, you know?
Right.
So that's like one part of what they did. And even after the Western cinema ended the exports and they stopped making them, they converted to talkies, Japanese continued to have the silence. I mean, they started talkies as well, so it's not just...
Yeah, because I think there were some in the 40s by Uzo. In the 40s.
Exactly, yeah. So it was parallel, but it was still tremendously popular well into the 40s because it became an art form unto itself. And in Japan, like a lot of these ancient cultures, they love to hold on to old things until it's totally exhausted. Anyways, all right, go on. Did you have anything else?
Nope, that's it.
I had a chance to check out... What did I check out? I don't think I quite finished it, but I started I'm forgetting the title now. I'm very forgetful today. I think it was the Lon Chaney Notre Dame movie. I think I started it a little bit. And I don't think I made much rest, but it was a really good kickoff. It's a lot of these great classics of the silent era really does feel like it was made just in recent times, just like the one we're going to talk about. It really doesn't feel like they were made, almost 100 years ago. It's quite amazing.
Well, the top directors copied a lot of what they saw.
Of course. Of course.
Scorsese loves silent.
Yeah. With that, let's get into it. So, The Wind, 1928. One of the last silent films ever made, I think, in the era of time, especially by Victor Seastrom, the Swedish director.
Uh-huh.
The plot would be, how would I describe the plot? The plot is there's this character, Letty. She is a Virginian, right? Who seems like she, didn't have anything or lost everything and moved to somewhere in Midwest, maybe West somewhere.
Texas.
Sweetwater, that's what Texas.
That's the novel, but we don't know for sure what state they actually said in the movie. But the, so she moved to rejoin her cousin. What was her cousin's name?
Beverly.
Beverly, that's right.
That's right.
Which apparently is a male name, at least it was popular back then. Probably less so today. But
yeah.
Anyway, so she, to live with her cousin to kind of just, I guess, continue to live her life. And, little does she know, the wind in this part of the country is so tremendous that it would kind of overtake and overwhelm many parts of her life. And, she's very much had the good life and now kind of getting confronted with the realities of frontier life. And it's a completely different lifestyle than what she's used to. And kind of that's the conflict of that, but also just... various different antagonists along the way, where, you know, there are people who are trying to marry her and or swindle her and stuff like that. So that's kind of the plot, general plot line. We can get into more detail as we go along. Lily, yeah. What'd you think of this film?
Oh, I thought it was excellent. I'm glad, you know, we finally got a chance to watch it, because it does feel so modern for being a silent film, even though it was at the beginning of the talkies. I don't know. It was just, the acting was really good. I liked how, you know, it just the basis of the stories that, like we said, this girl has nothing. She goes from nowhere to nowhere, but she's trying to get somewhere. And I feel like, well, that's relatable to everybody. Even though it was hard to see, being that it was black and white, you could tell what they were trying to accomplish with their cinematography. You know, you get all those landscapes whenever you can, showing the house being buried in granules of sand. Like, it was insane. Because we watched the ending, or the beginning, with Lily and Gish talking about being filmed in, I believe she said, the Mojave Desert, and what they had to do to get the wind to kick up like that. So just learning all those details made this movie a little more fascinating to me. Because really, I don't know too many movies that use sand anymore. I mean, the most recent one was the reboot of Mad Max, which was actually really good. I have seen that one. I've seen that movie all the way through. It was excellent. But yeah, I feel like it's kind of like an avoidable earth substance if you can get away with it, unless you're at the beach. So I liked how they vitalized that gritty, you know, abrasive effect to the film, because it kind of does rub off on all the characters in that respect. Everybody is a little gritty. Everyone is a little abrasive. Besides Beverly, who's actually seems pretty chill. And then Lillian Gish does get, you know, slowly more rough, because she has to be, in order to survive. So that was my take on it. Yeah, I've been wanting to see this movie for so long, and I'm so happy we did. But I will say, I thought, from seeing other clips of other movies she's been in, I thought, there's this one scene where she's, like, crying and screaming in a closet.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know, maybe you guys know what film that was, but I actually thought that she was doing that in The Wind.
I think that's Broken Blossoms.
Oh, yep, that's actually right. That's Broken Blossoms, because I know she's supposed to be a child in it.
Yeah, 12. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, cool. Thank you, Adam. So I was like, okay, what was this one? What was it?
Yeah.
What'd you think of it, Adam?
Oh, okay. I wasn't sure if you were winding up. When you originally asked for us to watch this, I had it confused with A Romance of the Redwoods with Mary Pickford. And that's what I had in my head. I watched that at the festival. That's the one where she was having a run-in with DeMille. So I had a completely different movie, but in some ways it was similar. But anyway, I had watched The Scarlet Letter before. And so Lillian was in charge of putting this movie together. I guess the one who usually runs things was overworked, so he would always hand it off to her because she knows what she's doing. So she picked the same director, Victor Sjostrom.
Yeah, Louis B. Mayer, who's the studio head, MGM, I think.
Did she say a different name? Because it was that clip you gave us.
Yeah,
I don't remember
that. I think it's that guy.
Could be. I just thought the lead, Lars Hansen, he was a very good choice. You know, he had the leading man looks, but then again, he was able to do subtle acting. When it came to the wedding night, the changes he went through just like right in front of us was really, really subtle. I don't know how much directing that took or if he just knew his way already. Because, I mean, they're supposed to be a much younger couple, but she was like 33. He was about 40. But they were playing, I'm guessing, early. Maybe she could have been even like 18, 19. But the acting, I just thought in general, was amazing. There were only two females, and the other actress was you knew what she was about immediately. You didn't have to guess what she was feeling. Here she was acting masculine while this dainty thing comes in from the East Coast, not knowing, how to be out there and how to survive. The thing that really got me in general was I couldn't understand why anybody would want to settle in a place that had that much wind. I mean, why would you? But then the more I read of different people who wrote different things about it, they were saying a lot of it was in her own head. She was used to Virginia, so when she's seeing this, you're seeing it through her eyes, where she's imagining kind of some of it. I mean, they do have rough winds, but I don't think it was as much as we were seeing her picture. I always loved miniatures. When the rain, when the train was coming through, I just really enjoyed the artistry they had in putting something like that together.
Yeah, just like
That mansion.
yeah, what was that movie we just watched last week?
Castle, Haunted Castle.
Haunted Castle. That's the
Yeah.
Haunted Castle. Getting very forgettable. The Haunted
So
Castle with the mansion, yes.
I
So
always
like I was
zoom in
saying,
on something like that.
it's pretty much very common, I think. All these films they've had to use that for exterior.
But I've said why. It's because I grew up watching those puppet shows. So to me, that's what I kind of zoom in on. Let's see. Just I just thought I love the contrast where she was still living with her cousin, and she was ironing her outfits. Meanwhile, the wife is basically gutting a cow in the same room with the apron and everything. And when she was being approached by two different men, I just love the way the wife says, "Well, you're gonna have to pick one of them because you're not staying with us anymore." The her husband, he really seemed to be a background character. I mean, he was the linchpin, but then again, he wasn't. The way the comic relief Sourdough and Lige had to compete for the same woman, and it was obvious to everyone watching that Lige would win. But they had to do a shooting contest. I love the cyclone that was coming at them. It was like a prototype to Wizard of Oz. It's just I guess the story ended differently in the book, where she went crazy and just ran out and died that way. But it was a kind of an argument whether it was changed for the movie later on or if it was done up front. It's still confusing to me on when it was done. But I seemed to I thought it was the way the characters was built up and where the scenes built up that it ended the way, that was, doable. And that's it.
Alrighty, Fong, your take.
Would you rate that as one of the greatest silent films ever made, or?
Yeah, that along with The Man Who Laughs. I liked both.
The Man There Was, you mean?
The
Or
man,
the...
no, The Man Who Laughs.
Oh, right, that the... Okay, yeah, that's the
Or
other
the,
one.
yeah, that's the right title, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
Because Victor Sjostrom also made another movie called A Man There Was, which was a short,
Yeah.
like a 40-minute or something.
Yeah, was that the one where he was near the ocean?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, yeah, I saw that and the one that was done right afterwards, Allah and his wife.
Yes, so
And I
he.
think you mentioned it before, and I was confusing the two.
Yeah. So that particular film, which is a adaptation of the Ibsen work, but the net sum is that he loves to utilize nature
Nature,
to
yeah.
symbolize or maybe perhaps add to. I mean, the wind is obviously a character in this movie,
Oh, yeah.
which back then was probably, I don't know, befuddling is the right word, but just kind of confusing to a lot of audiences. I'm
Oh,
not sure
yeah.
that they were quite ready for things like this. But nowadays, we've seen so many movies, and it's like,
Yeah.
it's very common, I think, in many ways.
I like the way she did the dishes. She was
Yes.
washing it in sand.
Yeah.
So,
But
yeah.
just like his Man There Was, nature essentially is one of the characters that's just grating, and like you guys had mentioned, is something that was it is one of the foremost antagonists in this film. It's the whole notion that there's only like seven stories or basic plots, man versus
Yeah.
man versus nature, man versus whatever there is. And
Boy
so
gets girl.
Yeah, but it usually has a man something versus something in there. There's like man versus machine, man versus nature, man versus God, man versus et cetera, et cetera. It goes down the list, but
right.
I don't think I've ever seen this one because, you know, since the early 2000s, that's when I did most of my silent film watching. There have been many, many, many releases of silent films. And, you know, I obviously didn't watch all of them even back then that was available to me. But I think that I was able to get to what I could have at that time. And this is one of those titles that, you know, it wasn't on DVD. And I don't know. I don't know when the VHS came out, and I just didn't really seek after it. I think I was trying to get what was most convenient, which was on DVD, and most of the VHS ones I didn't really seek after. So this is one of those titles that probably were, you know, was released on VHS in the 80s or 90s, but I didn't really, you know, chased after it and looked for it. But I will say that my preconception of this film, I was thinking in my mind something more along the lines of I don't know if there's a movie like this, but I was in my mind, I was, when I heard of the film, I was just thinking that it's a movie where Ilyin Gish has to move somewhere in the Dust Bowl area with all these type of weather conditions, and she's kind of like, have you guys heard of John Steinbeck, The Grapes of Wrath? You guys?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Never read it.
Yeah,
but you get the story, right? You get the story, the film. There's there's a movie, too. I think.
Yeah, I have seen the film in eighth grade.
Right. So at least you know the storyline. The point of the storyline is that, you know, everybody has a hard life and they got to make it. I mean, that's very high level. There's a lot more to the movie, but in the book. But I think I was thinking more like that. But repackaged as a Ilyin Gish vehicle, where she's this one woman person. She moves out in the middle of nowhere,
not striking a bell.
Yeah, and like her against.
And I've seen a lot of her stuff too.
Right, right. So I was thinking, I was more thinking that this is a movie like that, like she's like, you know, trying to grow something, and be a farmer, and so when
she was tougher in that one then.
No, no, no. I was thinking that The Wind is a movie about that. I was thinking
Right. But that movie sounds like she'd be more tough where The Wind she wasn't. She was.
That's exactly my point. It's
she
like,
was blown away, literally.
Right. Well, I was thinking that she would move out there. She didn't know what she was getting to, but she was like,
oh, yeah,
committed to the life. That was the movie that I was imagining in my head when I first heard of The Wind over the years.
Are you sure that wasn't in the 60s? The one you just mentioned? Because that sounds like, I hadn't seen it, but it sounds like a synopsis I read.
Oh, well, maybe. I don't know. If you can find it.
Because I read D.W. Griffith and Me, and when she wrote that book, she was doing that movie, and that's the only reason why I knew about it.
Yeah, if you can find that movie. I don't know. I don't think I've seen IMDb. All her movies, so I can't claim that I've seen all her movies, because she made a huge, you know, crap load of movies. But
oh, yeah.
Anyway, so I was thinking that was going to be the plot of this film because, you know, if you think about her storied career, I really think that she does push a lot of those agendas of, like, the women's rights and having very strong female characters in spite of the circumstances and stuff like that. You know, I think she does try to push for that. It doesn't always come through, but I know that, you know, she's, like, one of the best actresses of the silent era, you know, and she's built up some power, and even especially around the late 80s, 1920s, and she's capable of pushing some of these storylines through. Anyways, the point was, that's
warning,
what I was thinking. And
warning shot, maybe?
How's that?
Warning shot? I'm just looking through the IMDb. During a stick. Oh, no, that's not it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And even like, I think even like the previous efforts, like you saw, Scarlet Letter, and I feel like there's a lot more stronger, the female versus a lot more rounded character with inner life, with sort of gumption and stuff like that. But I had no idea that, because I never read the novel and I hadn't seen the movie, but I had no idea that the film was actually about a dainty sort of person that was in a better economic class, and all of a sudden, you know, her providers, her parents just died or something.
Yeah.
And this is according to the novel. We don't really get that context in the film itself, but the novel paints it that way. And that she basically had to go to her surviving relative to survive.
Right.
And so we'll put this link. We'll put a couple of these links in the show notes. But there is like somebody, I can't remember the name now, but there's somebody wrote a college paper on that. Now, I sent it around. If you guys had a chance to read it. But he did some analysis on it. And then there's another one by Fritzi, Movie Silently, who did an analysis of sort of the three myths or misconceptions about the win, right? Mm-hmm. And so the three of them was that, you know, MGM slapped on a happy ending. Well, it was never shot. So if the ending was never shot, it couldn't have existed.
Right.
So that's the records. She went to primary research and figured it out, and that was great. That's a great site, by the way. Movie Silently, highly recommend it. And the second myth is that the tragic ending still exists somewhere in Europe, some print somewhere, and that can't happen again. The print never existed. So it's just, you know, it's hard to dispute this, but sometimes with the MGM intro, not MGM, what's it called? TCM restoration, when they reshowed it on cable TV, she had to do a couple of minutes intro. She's either misremembering things or have their own perspective. You know, that's what happens over the years, is that sometimes these Hollywood legends will have their way of remembering things and how they try to remember that.
She's
detail.
Done so much. So to even remember, you know, something that far back.
Right, exactly. And that's not just her, but like a big chunk of the original stars. In fact, if you, and I probably mentioned this on this podcast before, but many, many, many of the greats, like the Douglas Fairbanks, like the Raoul Walsh, or like these famous directors and stars, they view media as something to play and toy with. They don't like view it as something where they're actual truth tellers. They just view it as another moneymaker that's kind of using them. Then they are the product. So even back then, they feel like, in a social media sense, that they know that they are the product. And so they would never tell like them the real story. I mean, they were like, have things, they would say that they would make up stories, you know, in the news media. And so when you say it long enough, you start believing it, you know? So,
The more I watch Lillian, the more I have respect for her. I've seen her in some 50s films too.
Right, right. So the point is, she may not have remembered all these things the way that the records were. And it wasn't shot in Mojave Desert. It was shot in San Joaquin Valley, which is about, I just Googled mapped it, it's about 8 hours away. So it's not even nowhere near Mojave Desert.
Right? Oh, whoops.
And the max high was like 105 or 80s or 90s. It's really not 120 degrees. So there's a lot of like myths built around these things. Having said that, it was still, I think, you know, that doesn't detract from it. But what is interesting is the way that Fritzi compared the plot lines of both the novel and the book. The novel, the first half of the movie generally is on point with the novel, but then the second half is where it deviates. Specifically the plot where in the book itself, the wife, Letty, does not tell the husband, Lige, that she doesn't love him. So he doesn't know. She just kind of pretends that everything's normal.
Right.
So that's the difference. And then she basically, the reveal that she's not in love with him is at the end. That's the climax of the film. And Lige, the main character, is still distraught that he went out. And he basically either never comes back or doesn't come back for a long time. At the very, very end of the film, she actually, after the whole, what's the other character? Roddy. Roddy comes back, you know, and she kills him, she actually runs out into the desert and just presumably dies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the husband leaves, doesn't come back. So that's the plot of the book. And in the plot of the film, they have to change a lot of that dramatically, because in the book, the narrative is taking like a, Adam says, inside of her head. So in the book, in the novel, you have the luxury of time, and you have luxury of words and chapters and things, sentences, and you can build all these things by, you know, digging into a person's perspective in
psyche.
In psyche, and writing what's going on internally. And so that's, I think, one of the things that Adam mentioned was that potentially the second half of the film could potentially all be inside of her head, of just the struggle against the wind and stuff like that. And
yeah, I just couldn't see anyone settling in a place that did that forever.
Right. So, but anyway, so that's kind of the differences between the plot, because in the film, she lets him know right away, because I think part of the narrative is that you got to have tension, right? That's the beauty of films, right, is that you got to always build that tension. And with that tension right then and there, that allows, you know, the way it plays out towards the end, where then she conquers her fears, as it were.
Right. Well, I loved the back at the wedding night, the shots of the feet just pacing back and forth.
That was a good one. Yeah.
But even before that happened, just the look on his face, you know, Lars Hansen, he was so good.
He's done a lot of other stuff. I don't remember if I've seen it. I may have. I can't remember.
Well, I've only seen him in The Scarlet Letter.
Right. So they reunited for this, I think. So.
Right. Well, she basically called him out.
Right.
She was in charge.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's the beautiful thing about this film is I think all of the different ways that it represents different things. Lily just said, you know, you talk about how everybody is abrasive, like the grain of sand, and also how I think the sand is a character. And so I just think that the character is my own personal interpretation. I don't know if I read it anywhere. But it's
well, what about the horse?
Yeah. Oh, of course, the horse. But I'm talking about just the sand and the storm and
right,
the wind.
Right.
I feel like that is like epitomized through the Roddy character. I feel in the train when we first meet up with Letty's character, you know, we don't see the wind at all. But it's right after meeting Roddy on the train that the wind really shows up, and I feel like it's personified. The wind, yes, but also the wind and Roddy basically are one and the same. And Roddy is a human form of the wind, I think. And so, you know, and every time Roddy comes and tries to approach Letty, it's always about, can you survive the wind? Can you, right from the get-go, it's like, is it going to wear down? You're going to go crazy. And, you know, and she even, I mean, with everything, he's trying to get her away from this place, just like the wind is.
He brought the tornado then.
right. That's kind of the thing, is that he's synonymous with this whole weather symbolizing a force that is trying
to... The force of nature against an immovable object, yeah.
Something like that, yeah. So I feel like there's definitely some ties, I think, from a character perspective that they have, which is brilliant, because the screenwriter, you know, that adapted this. So the novel's written by a woman, and the screenwriter is female, and the producer essentially is a linguist, which is female, and the star is a female. Yeah. It's like, I love all of this, you know. Anyway, so I that's like my take on that specific thing. But I also thought that the actual lighting was really well done, especially when the light went out and she has to light a lamp or something, or a lantern, and kind of move that around the room in the dark. I mean, all of that is just brilliant. The cinematography, the camera work, what it symbolizes.
They were lucky they didn't get blinded.
Right.
You know, the actors. And the special, they show all the people behind the cameras wearing goggles.
Right, right.
But these people had to be in front of the sand.
Yeah. So everything about it, I just really enjoy, and you know, remember that a lot of this nature is a character in the film is actually something that F.W. Murnau also adapts to, because it's highly influential. He really enjoyed Victor C. Strom's work, and so it does rear its head in his film as well.
What do you think of the music?
The music is Carl Davis, which is one of the greatest, I think, accompanists of our time, at least modern times, for silent films. So I enjoy it. I didn't see the other version. There's been two, possibly more versions. The version that we saw is the TCM restoration, which did commission Carl Davis to write it. Mm-hmm. But there is another version. I feel like some people like the other version. I don't know. I haven't seen the other.
I don't remember it now, because I watched it previously on Criterion, and I don't remember if the music was any different or if they used the same one.
Yeah.
Well, I really don't know.
Are you talking about The Wind?
Yep.
I don't think The Wind's on DVD yet. It's just been on
No, VHS. It was on Criterion. I belong to the channel. And they had it, and they took it away.
Oh, you mean The Wind?
Right.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, I caught it just before it ran its course, and the license ran out. So, I had watched it before, and then I watched this version. I honestly don't remember if the music was any different, but I know the wind sound effect was obviously there.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's why I saw it. I thought it seemed, well, about the same quality as what you showed me, but it's been 2 months since I've seen it.
Yeah.
So, but I just thought, you know, music makes the movie for me.
Yeah, well, music is tough with the silent era because there's, you know, some film composers who've done some historic research says, on one hand, you have people who've done some research and they're like, majority of the greatest silent films, they all have original music and score written. Mm-hmm. And then some are like, well, you know, you can kind of just play it by ear just because... Once it lands at the specific venue that the film plays, the accompanist doesn't always go with the original music, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So there's different attitudes about original scores and music for films.
Yeah.
So.
Like I said, it was on Criterion, so I got to see it. This is my second time around.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I was going to make another comment about the... Whoops, what were you going to say?
No, go
what
ahead.
Were you going to say? I was just going to make another comment about how good the music was with this. At least for me, this is how I saw it. So, like, when the part Letty is attacked by Cora, that's Beverly's wife.
Uh-huh.
It's just, I really... My note was just to myself was that I love how you can hear the hiss and the rattle of the wind creep into the music before you really know what's going on. It's the subtleties... that you know what's coming, maybe from the fourth wall, even if it isn't explicitly known yet. So it just, you know what I mean? You could kind of hear the trickle of the music, of the sound, of the wind coming in before it really flourished, before really William Gish turned to see it. So I just thought that was good composing right there. I'm hoping that they may have seen the film prior to kind of do that, but for me that
With
icing on the cake.
Sure, yeah.
I was like, oh, so good.
with this score by Carl, they for sure have had to do this. This is not something that you do, you make it up on the spot.
Yeah.
Because
they
basically were showing this on the TCM channel. So they did a restoration of the original print, I think, and then also commissioned new music with Carl Davis and
Got
everything packaged up correctly.
Yeah, I thought it worked. I really liked it.
Yeah, and that stallion, I don't know what that represents. But
I thought it was, according to that first article you sent us, it represented the Native Americans being displaced, and that was their spirit.
That's one interpretation of it. But
It's
probably sexual in nature in some ways. Because
well, they said that too, yeah.
Because I think it started... when did it start? It started with when... She got off the train and she thought that the person picking her up was her cousin Beverly, but it turned out to be Lige, right, and Sardo. And so Lige, when it was either him or Sardo was describing the wind, that's when the imagery first started. Which, by the way, has some ties to Phantom Carriage, which
yes.
Chisholm also did. But,
I saw that.
What were you going to say?
Who?
You, Adam, you were about to say something.
Oh,
interrupted.
No, I was just agreeing with you.
Oh, okay.
I was just saying yes.
Oh, okay. I thought you were something else. But yeah, that's so I feel like, you know, when she mistook him for the cousin, I feel like already some sexual tensions there. And then as it subsequently shows up, I think it represents some of that. I also think that, like, towards the end, when Roddy comes back, so the plot of the detail is that you know, they came upon somebody who is injured, so they bring the injured person. This is after Legion and Roddy gets married. After they get married, Roddy goes to work and finds somebody and brings that somebody back, I'm sorry, the Leech, the husband. And then it turns out that person is Roddy, who's injured. And so they basically are like, because of hospitality or some weird law reason or something, yeah. Culturally, they're like, I got to take care of this person until they're well. And so the person ends up being Roddy, right? Which we know is that Roddy's just like the scoundrel who is married, but just trying to sleep with mm-hmm. Letty. That's kind of his goal.
Mm-hmm.
So his purpose is pretty apparent. But the fact that, you know, he's in their house now is, you know,
yeah,
it's very conflicted. Anyways, long story short, the husband, Leech, has to go somewhere else and invites Roddy to go along. So they all go out together and they ride in the horse. But then he stops and turns around and goes back, Roddy does, to the house. And that, I think, specific scene, again, where the stallion shows up is where she's unconscious somehow. And I think the story takes place is that the connotation is that Roddy rapes her, I think, in the right. story. It takes a dark turn in the story. In the novel, he does, and then she kills him, stuff like that. So that's about the same. The only difference is that how it plays out is the husband doesn't come back, and then she goes out to die. That's kind of how it plays out. With this film, because this...
Yeah, I like the happy ending better.
Yeah,
well,
I do too.
That's a little too much.
Well, it's not just that. It's more like the way it's been set up. The second half of the film was part of what the movie Silently uh-huh. review was talking about, which Frizzy's talking about. But basically, it's like, you know, you've built up this character who is on this trajectory, and all of a sudden to kill her basically makes her one of those, like, you know, once she's used up and raped, then she has to kind of just be dead. It's a sacrificial virgin type thing, you know. There's a whole like theme behind that, which is very common apparently. So, but anyways, the point was, this is pre-code, so you can't really even show a lot of stuff. It has to be totally implied, right?
Uh-huh.
But even above and beyond that, I feel like there's this, in the film, there's I feel like there's a potential where that was imagined too, you know, whether she killed him or not. Because Roddy is a character that the other characters have interactions with, so we know he's real in terms of, like, it's not imagined, right? So because otherwise everything would be imagined, you know, everything, right? Including the husband, including everything. But so you can't go there. But if she imagined Roddy, then Roddy is like a real character, a real person. It's not like a fake imaginary person, right? Because he has interactions with everyone else, right?
Well, the part that we weren't sure what she was imagining is after she buried him, whether he was being uncovered
exactly,
or not.
Exactly. Yeah. And that is the gray area. You know, did she imagine killing him, that part? Or did he just cut, like, not even come to her house? Or what's the deal, you know? So that...
Even the way he died was done well. You know, he just like, I can't believe he just did that.
Yeah. It's also kind of graphic in terms of in silent film era, right? This is pre-code, but you know what that means, right, Adam? Pre-code, Hays code.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, the late
late
20s were when things are starting, but they didn't really enforce it until 1934. That's when things started to take place.
Well, Barbara Stanwyck did a lot of pre-code, so right. Yep. I know it well.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, that's the plot. Part of the plot that's, I guess, interesting for the character reasons. You know.
Again, it's compared to some of the other silence I've seen, it was just a relief to see something done well like that.
Right. What do you think of that, Lily? I don't know if you read the articles, but I'm just distilling some of the articles.
Oh, no, I didn't get a chance to read the articles.
Well, we just summarized it.
Well, I'm glad. Yeah, really. I'm very glad because I still want to read them. But, yeah, today was a very busy day for me. And I was just like, you can send these great articles through the chat. And I was just like, oop, I do not have time to read these.
That's all right. But anyways, so that's kind of the details towards the end of the films. But knowing that, do you think it was an empowering film for women? Because you speak for all women, right? That's what we...
Oh, yeah. 20 years old and I know what's
That's
up.
Why you're on the podcast, right?
Well, I guess we need a little bit of diversity.
Sure thing.
Whatever. I don't know.
I'm kidding, by the way. Go ahead.
Well, cool. hearing how the story was supposed to go, I'm glad the ending was changed. I mean, I will say, watching it, it is kind of sappy to have a happy ending, but it wasn't terrible. It wasn't what you want, but it's what you got. excuse me. You know, I can't really say that Lillian Gish's character really stood up. I mean, she stood up for herself at the very end because she wasn't going to take Roddy's crap. But I don't know. At the same time, I feel like a better ending would have been she would take Lige away with her somewhere else. I mean, even if the whole concept of the wind's supposed to be driving her to insanity and she can't take it anymore, but then that kind of disperses once Roddy's dead, I still feel like that presence is there, so why do you want to... Why would you want to stay in that same area with people that... Like you said, they don't want you there. So I feel like maybe it could have been rewritten in the script to... Like... They just travel off together. I feel like that would have been more satisfactory for me. Instead of them just, like, kissing in their front porch and the wind's blowing. And I was like,
I think the point might be that she's... Once Roddy, the character, and also the wind, represents her fears of the wind. And once her fear is dead and she says, I'm not afraid of anything anymore, the wind isn't so much the thing that is driving her mad. It's her internal struggle. It's that her internal struggle is done and she's grown and she's no longer a dainty dame who's got to rely on other people for handouts. At least that's what the movie's trying to imply, is that she's basically going to be like Beverly's wife, a frontierswoman who is able to butcher steers if needed. You have to be whatever you need to be to get things done as a frontierswoman, mm-hmm. right? There's no like...
It's a hard
being
life.
Dainty about anything. You know, it's a totally different lifestyle. And the implication behind that is that her character has changed and embraced that lifestyle. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if they actually left that, then she would continue to be dainty and unchanged, as it were.
I guess, yeah. I mean, you always want change in your stories, especially for female roles, because it always seems to be lacking in that respect, because you don't want the female character to be one and done. Because usually she's used as a plot device, at least more commonly nowadays.
It's which the Bechdel test, right?
Yeah. And
yep.
It just pisses people off, both, you know, women and men occasionally. But I would really have to do a deep dive and, like, think about a better answer for this question. Not on this podcast, if I would say, oh, you know, repressed. Oh, not so repressed. A little bit of both. I don't know.
It's a little bit like Gone with the Wind, a little bit. Mm-hmm. Kind of.
But I feel like I haven't seen Gone with the Wind. I know how powerful that movie's supposed to be, too, but I almost feel like
it's Letty's already...
I'm glad this wasn't. I already feel like Letty's already so much farther ahead than the other people in Gone with the Wind. Because I know they're like... It's Civil War era, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So... I don't know. I almost feel like Lillian Gish's character is in a better spot than the people in Gone with the Wind. Because I know of the movie, and I know it's a book, and I know how amazing it's supposed to be, and how critical it can be now. But it's like, do I know the characters? Not really.
Would I add it to the list.
Oh, God. My never-ending list. I don't know. I was just thinking, like, Letty seems like a full character, and for the people with Gone with the Wind, I couldn't tell you who the characters are. So that's just my two cents. People may disagree outside this podcast, and if you do, leave us a comment. but yeah, that's my two cents.
What? Any parting thoughts? I think that's probably good enough for today, unless you want to add something else. But any parting thoughts, last words?
No, the music was my last one.
Yeah. They enjoyed it, or?
Oh, yeah. Completely. Like absolutely. I said, the music to me makes it. I hate it when they have a film and there's no music and you have to make up your own and it doesn't go and just ruins it. But I wondered how they, I guess if the wind wasn't as bad as was in her head, I was wondering how they grow like vegetables or fruit or any, you know, do they only eat meat?
I'm sure some history book. Lived. I'm sure some history book about the Dust Bowl would answer that.
Yeah, I heard the Dust Bowl was man-made, as far as the Grapes of Wrath.
Oh, I don't know.
That documentary that was made by Ken Burns. Uh-huh. Yeah, it was telling us that was man-made, and I never knew that.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. That was the 30s. So, any other parting thoughts before we conclude today? And by the way, to your thing about music, Adam, I like the scene when they're in the dancing, the dance in the middle.
Yep.
And the music itself reflected whatever's going, the dance music. Like when they were going to the dance music, you'd have the violin. And...
Oh, yeah. I think what really impressed me about that whole thing was this, at the end, I think it said it was restored in 88.
Right.
I didn't realize it was going on that far back. I thought once things digitized, that's when it really got going. But
they've been restoring movies since the 30s, 40s, and 50s. I mean, think about it. If you were made a silent film in the teens or 20s, you need to restore a little bit of that for the 30s and 40s. So they've been restoring movies since then, since forever. So
okay, yeah. I've just been paying attention to it the last 20 years.
The best restorations is actually not digital, but rather physical, because you have to like bathe the film print chemicals. You have to do special
handling. I saw that
handling.
Documentary. Yeah. They made a special machine to handle it with the rubber or something, or some kind of material
nowadays,
that doesn't.
But imagine not having any of those machines, and you
were
in the 30s and 40s.
Then you had to use the sprockets. Yeah.
I don't even know what they did, but however they do it, they still had to clean it up, restore it, and make it a clean print so that you can make copies off of the master print, you know?
Well, I know Nosferatu, they said they had to wet it with oils just to get rid of the some of the scratches. So I know they don't do that now.
All right, any other parting thoughts then?
I'm good.
I love this movie.
You like it? Good. I'm sure you can watch it again over and
over. Yay!
You should watch The Scarlet Letter then.
Oh my god, I hated that book. It was awful. I hate Nathaniel Hawthorne.
The book was bad. It went on forever.
It went on forever.
Yes. Well, those things were written as magazine installments. Yeah, I hate books that were written in the 1800s. It was, actually, that one might have been 1700s, but still. But this was Lillian Gish about a year or two before that doing The Scarlet Letter with, the same people, basically.
Same director. Yeah.
But also the same lead man, Lars Hansen.
Yeah.
And I guess Greta Garbo was always hanging around the set because those two were together when she did that film.
Yeah, well, who wasn't she with, right? So.
Well, it was interesting because you could see Greta just taking Lars away from the camera. Come on. I'm sure. Come on, baby. Yeah. But, I saw that basically... I saw that first, and then I saw The Wind right afterwards because they were both on Criterion.
Yeah,
Criterion's a big one for me.
Cool.
Okay.
All right. Well, my parting thoughts is that it definitely ranks as one of the classics. I wish I had pursued the VHS copy long ago, but I'm still glad I've seen it today. Well, you know what this film really needs is a modern restoration, a remastering. Mm. I think it's still available just as a VHS, and the only DVD you can get is an import from, like, I don't know, somewhere in Europe, Italy, France, somewhere, I don't know. And the DVD itself is still even just a copy
a
or
transfer
dupe of the VHS. Yeah. So, like many films from these, earlier eras, especially ones that are even as great as this movie, they really deserve more attention. And hopefully somebody somewhere is, going to spend some money to try to preserve this for just future generations, right? Because I'm sure the print's sitting somewhere and hopefully it's not deteriorating. And, there's a good print that you can still work off of and use and make a good, clean copy,
Hope so, too.
So it's one of those film preservation things, if nobody really... pays attention, in another 10-20 years, and if the ravages of time marches on, and we might lose some of these master prints, right? We'll only have really scrappy copies.
The master prints, yeah. You know where they do find a lot of lost films are those 16 millimeters and sometimes 9.5 millimeters that were done for the public.
Right.
Sometimes that's their only copy to work with.
Yeah, because you had a distributor like Blackhawk from Iowa selling these prints that you can order, mail order, or call and get an order of.
Well, that's where Kevin Brownlow discovered Napoleon through his 9.5.
Yeah. Well, that's what they use in the UK, is a 9.5. Yeah. But anyways, so yeah, that's our take on The Wind and Lilinkish and a bunch of people. And it's an amazing film. Highly recommend it. You have time to check it out. And we'll post some links in the show notes and go from there. So thanks, listeners. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Lily. And we'll chat again next time. You can find more of our stuff at watchingsilentfilms.wordpress.com. Again, that's watchingsilentfilms.wordpress.com. You can send us an email, the same, watchingsilentfilms@gmail.com. And please leave us a rating, a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you can find our podcasts. And thanks, everyone. Have a good evening.
Bye, people.
Thank you.
Bye.